Hello and welcome to the Nordic Africa Institute podcast. I'm Heba Habib, Communications Officer at the Institute. The Nordic Africa Institute is a six-year-old knowledge hub devoted to deepening understanding of contemporary Africa. This podcast, which we have semi-jokingly titled Don't Quote Me on That, is a series of conversations with our researchers, analyzing the issues of the day. With me is my colleague, Henrik Alfredsson, who will introduce our guests and today's episode.
Thank you, Heba. So, on October 12th, the United Nations General Assembly voted on a resolution to condemn Russia's attempted illegal annexation of four Ukrainian regions and to reaffirm the territorial integrity of Ukraine. The outcome of the vote was that 143 countries, that is three quarters of the 193 UN member states, voted in favor of the resolution and only five against. This is pretty much a reflection of the vote which was made in the General Assembly on March 2nd, about a week after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. At that time, the resolution was about demanding Russia to end its offensive in Ukraine. In both these votes, we can see a pattern where the African states stand out from the rest of the world. In March, for example, 48% of Africa's countries voted against, abstain, or were absent, compared to only 19% of the rest of the world. In October, the difference was slightly smaller, 44 to 19%. In today's podcast episode, we'll talk about these results. And with us here to discuss them are Henning Melber, a political scientist with a focus on global governance and Southern Africa. Henning is an Nye associate, extraordinary professor at the University of Pretoria and the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein, both in South Africa. He's also a senior research fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies at the School for Advanced Study, University of London. And we also have Kwesi Anyin, a peace and conflict researcher with a focus on African peacekeeping and security politics. Kwesi is a professor and director of the Faculty of Academic Affairs at the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center in Accra, Ghana. He's also the holder of the 2022 Claude Ake Visiting Chair at the Nordic Africa Institute and Uppsala University Department of Peace and Conflict Research. So, Heba.
Welcome, gentlemen. A delight to have you here, even though we're just popping up from the office downstairs, but nonetheless, lovely to have you. So, my first question for you is, why do you think that there was a shift in voting among African nations in the UN General Assembly?
Well, I mean, Heba, thank you. I mean, this question is very critical and very crucial, and it's been going back and forth, and it seems to me as if there is a bit of a surprise as to the voting patterns that have taken place. And I think there may be several reasons for this. One, that the continent forms the largest single bloc, almost about 28% of all the votes. Although there's an African Union, the countries don't speak with one voice. And I think it's critical in trying to understand these voting patterns that we look at it through the lens of the national interest. However, I want to make one particular point, that there are two things relating to international relations that cannot be overlooked. One is the issue of the right to self-determination and the role of international humanitarian law, even during conflict. That certain fundamental principles must be respected.
I think the term annexation, which is the core issue of that second resolution, comes too close to comfort from African perspectives. They were fighting for self-determination, for national sovereignty, and in the very early years, the Organization of African Unity had to deal with colonially drawn borders, separating communities. And they reached a very pragmatic solution. They said, we won't touch the borders. There were people in Africa who had to pay a high price. Just remember Biafra. There were other conflicts. And generally, African countries remained loyal to the principle you do not touch national territorial integrity. It's the only way to handle their own continental dynamics. And the Kenyan ambassador, when the first vote was taken, already highlighted that and made a very clear point. with reference to the UN Charter and the principle of sovereignty and territorial integrity. Interesting enough, while South Africa continued to abstain even in the second vote, the South African ambassador, when it was discussed, referred to self-determination and territorial integrity as a sacrosanct principle. One might wonder, and don't quote me on that, why then they would abstain after making that statement. But they emphasize the core issue which explains a shift in the votes. You do not annex territory of another country. That's even worse than going to war with another country.
I mean, let me just tie into what Kennedy said, that there's shifts in how the continent as a group speaking through the African Union, because the narrative from the African Union and its president or the chair, that's the president of Senegal, has diverged from what some individual member states have said. And I think were we to use a long-term historical lens, and I think Henning's point here about the discomfort plays a very key role. In the 50s and 60s, then it was a drive for the anti-colonial struggle. The subsequent, mid-60s to mid-1980s, was about the Cold War, you know, the bipolarity that meant that, you know, African states had to align themselves. Then in the aftermath of the Cold War, issues of democracy, autocracy, and the drive to get aid have been the fulcrum around which international relations have evolved. You know, so for quite a number of the African states, the particular choice of words in the resolutions occasionally brings some elements of discomfort. But I want also to make a point very clear, and here you may quote me on this, that I think there is a critical change and shift in the quality and the form of leadership, political leadership on the continent. So the quality of the discussions that, let's say, this afternoon, Henning and I are sitting here having, there are very few African states, particularly amongst the political leadership, where these conversations driven by principles and firm normative values drive the public agenda. And I think that is what we are seeing in these shifts and different patterns in the United Nations.
So I have another question. We've seen a lot of Western commentators puzzled over Africa's voting in these UN votes. Why do you think Africa's position is so critical to them?
There are certain material aspects which impact on the voting behavior of some of the countries. They are in different positions. It has to do with energy supply, with food security. In some countries, and Kwesi is able to highlight that in West Africa, on arms supply, on support to authoritarian regimes, which create a dependency not on the West, but on Russia. But I think there is another issue which actually Kwesi in his earlier contribution touched upon. The West has to be very careful to accuse other states of hypocrisy and double standards. In particular, if you look at it from an African perspective on the West, they are the advocates of human rights when it suits them. When it came to Mobutu Sese Seko, they bailed him out because it suited them too. So, if the West claims a moral high ground, then a lot of African countries find that appalling, if not insulting. So there is a psychological component which also impacts on voting behaviors from African perspectives. That's not supposed to be an excuse, but it's an explanation. There are fundamental principles, but they are often subject to definition if and how they are applied, and normally following individual particular interests. and Africa has most of the times been on the receiving end. So why should they subscribe to these fundamental principles and ignoring that they are selectively applied? That creates a certain reluctance to buy into a Western discourse because it comes from the West.
And I think on February 18th, 2022, I think just before the war started, both the EU and the African Union have signed a new partnership deal, basically titling it a renewed partnership. But immediately the war came up. I mean, we saw this rather instrumentalist shift in development aid. You know, countries that have provided logistics or peacekeeping, had those logistics shifted. The Danish government, with much noise, had brought in a Danish naval vessel to the Gulf of Guinea without any consultation with the 12 or 13 Gulf of Guinea states. The ship was moved to come and fight the war. Now, that raised fundamental questions on the continent as to the types of partnership that we are talking about. You know, so whilst there are fundamental principles about respecting the sovereignty of any state, respecting human rights, and using international humanitarian law when we go to war, I think Henning's point about the ad hocism with which that international principles are applied then raises fundamental questions about who our true friends are. And once more, I think Western European analysts made a very fundamental miscalculation in thinking Mr. Putin is their friend. Now, you allowed Mr. Putin to become your friend from when he came into power around 2008 until he annexed Crimea in 2014, and even as we speak today, people are buying oil and gas. You know, so to tell the world's most poorest nations, please bear the burden on our behalf, I think it's difficult. We need a new language, we need a new partnership, we need a new form of engagement.
And of course, selective perceptions kick in not only from the Western point of view, as we highlighted, but also from an African point of view. And Russia gets away with double standards. Russia claims never having been a colonizer. Well, that's true for Africa. But how can you explain that Russians who don't want to get into the army use a boat to reach Alaska from Russia? Now, how on earth can Russia stretch to the border of Alaska if it has never colonized? If you ask Asian communities, they tell a very different story. Of course, the Tsarist regime, Russia, even the Soviet Union were colonizers too. But the African perspective looks at the West colonizing the African continent and looks at Russia and saying they never colonized. Similar flawed is the perspective that Russia equates the former Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union in the Cold War supported the struggles for national independence and liberation on the African continent. Well, the Ukraine was a Soviet republic. So the Ukraine was the Soviet Union too. And again, there kicks a selectivity in, a kind of a knee-jerk response, which is more emotional and psychological than guided by any objective rationality. But that comes into the picture of almost any policy issue, especially when it comes to global governance and identity and affiliation with certain powers.
Do you think this voting pattern highlights the disunity in the African Union? And if you think that's the case, is it ever likely to unify, or is it even necessary for the African Union to unify on this, on Ukraine?
I think we need to understand that similar to the UN, the EU, the OSCE, the Shanghai Cooperation, and other multilateral frameworks, that this is a voluntary organization of equal member states. So although they may voluntarily sign on to certain documents in which their principles, normative values, and all that, the actual actual capacity to elicit compliance from an individual member state or behaving in a way that does not fit the framework, it's very difficult. You may bring about sanctions. So I think the point from where I sit is not to expect that individual member states should sign on or should vote in specific ways. I think we need to ask the fundamental question. What are the determinants of foreign policy choices made by specific states? And I think when we disaggregate those interests, in which we also decide that they are fundamental inalienable rights that we cannot and must not touch, then it will give us a much better grasp and understanding, and of course, opportunities for dialogue in shifting how states behave. But I think a blanket expectation that, you know, the EU has this position and therefore all member states should follow, I think will always create some problems for us.
I think the name change from OAU to AU, though not intended, signaled a very important semantic adjustment. It started as Organization of African Unity and ended as African Union. Now, union does not equate unity. And that's what is playing out. So what? How do you expect that 50 plus countries on a continent are always in agreement? They are allies of the West, of Russia, of China. They are members of the non-aligned movement, and even the non-aligned movement is divided. Why on earth should the African Union speak with one voice? I mean, that's really wishful thinking and not reflecting the realities of the individual countries on the ground who have different interests, different needs, and select their partners accordingly.
Speaking of the African Union, the AU has said in the past that it prefers a negotiated outcome to the Russian-Ukraine war, and that it doesn't condone sanctions. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think I would argue that anyone who has sort of looked at the way that the Peace and Security Council deals with international crisis will not be surprised by the phraseology. We saw similar phraseology when the Libyan crisis happened. And let me make this point. African states and African regional organizations have a very long memory, and we understand very clearly the way that the Union was pushed to the side during the Libyan intervention. I mean, Mr. Gaddafi was a big player on the African continent in terms of investment, ideology, the drive to shift from the organization of African unity to the Union, and the way that Tony Blair and co. basically made it impossible for the African Union even to find negotiated solutions is something that rankles very deeply still on the continent. So yes, those statements, the Union will continue them. But apart from arguing for a peaceful resolution, what true instruments that does Africa have? That's very little instrument, or very few instruments in the arsenal.
And sanctions from an African perspective remain a very touchy issue. Sanctions against Zimbabwe, sanctions against Cuba are critical issues which African states regularly raise in UN debates, in AU resolutions, because they feel it's, again, a double standard applied, because they have a memory of times when apartheid was condoned as a crime against humanity, and the West still refused to sanction the racist South African apartheid regime. Now again, if you apply sanctions in a selective way, in a way I just tried to point at, then do not expect from an African perspective that you welcome sanctions as a good tool.
So the EU seems to be becoming increasingly frustrated with Africa's position on Ukraine. A few months ago, DevEx leaked a 5-page document from the EU delegation to Africa, and that document seemed to indicate that the EU is contemplating becoming more transactional in its approach to Africa. How likely is this to happen? And is it even a good idea considering the fraught history between the continents?
Yeah, please move this.
Big question.
When I hear that word transactional, my hands are racing. I think of colonialism. That was transactional. Come on, give me a break. If the very countries whose wealth, whose global influence, whose power is built on the exploitation of a whole continent like the African one, in what you could call euphemistically a transactional deal, colonial exploitation, and then you come now, based on that history, and use a term like transactional in deals of today. Well, if I'm in the African's shoes, I would be up in arms. Who are you daring to apply such a perspective on us? And I think the EU should be very careful and eat much more humble pie on those issues.
No, I think the EU has lost the plot, really. Let's not forget that the African response to the war is something that has not just come. Let's not forget the approach to the war. We had COVID, and the EU's approach to providing, you know, COVID response was such that most African countries felt rather dejected. The EU's approach in shifting aid, taking away some of their logistics, or sort of continued to build or whatever, that Africa's relationship with the EU, even prior to the EU, with individual states, have always been transactional.
So now we're about to close up here. So I'll wrap up with a quick question. Algeria, South Africa, and Sudan, three of the in all 13 African countries who voted for abstention in the UN General Assembly, both in March and now also in October, are now part of the Human Rights Council. Is that likely to influence the collective African position on Ukraine?
Well, as I think we both, Kwesi and I, have repeatedly said, there is no collective African position. Why should it be in the Human Rights Council? I think very important to look at it in a positive way is, with the second vote, not a single African member country of the United Nations was in support of Russia any longer. That's the most important message to keep in mind.
And I think we need to embellish that dynamic, okay, to pull the African states gradually, respectfully, into the general fold.
And that's a wrap. Thank you so much, gentlemen. And please continue to listen to our humble little podcast with some brilliant minds. And thank you so much.
And keep in mind, don't quote us.
Thank you.